Well, one of the benefits of coming to live in America is being able to catch up on some TV series that used to be aired in Britain and Ireland, but then went over to Sky or cable. And so over the past few weeks, I've been doing the important work of catching up on Grey's Anatomy. I'm somewhere in season 14, so don't spoil it for me if you're way ahead in Grey's Anatomy. But there's a fascinating story going on about two doctors who are siblings, a brother and a sister. Both have served, they're veterans, served in the military. And Owen is currently working in the hospital. But his sister, Megan, was declared dead years ago after the helicopter that she was in transporting a patient through a war zone went missing, couldn't be found, and so she was presumed dead. And it's now 10 years later, Owen is working away in the hospital, and he's abruptly informed that his sister is alive after all those years. She's been in the basement of a home in a rebel-held village, and she's now being airlifted back home. And the problem that Owen has been working through is that for years he thought she was dead. That was his long-held belief. And he breaks down in front of his colleagues, not because he's scared of how Megan is going to be, what kind of condition she's in after all these years. But he feels ashamed and inconsolable because he realizes he'd been living without hope. All those years that he thought Megan was dead, he was living without hope. And you see, waiting for someone to return is hard, isn't it? Especially when you don't know how they're going to return and when they're going to return. How can you prepare practically for that? You can't store up the food, it's going to rot. You can't plan anything. You can't organize any reunions. Everything is on hold. So it's very difficult to wait in hope. So as I was walking around our neighborhood last night, looking at all these Christmas tree lights that had just in 24 hours appeared, it was quite something, the quick work, charging the air with this hope, this expectancy of the festive season. And even this morning as we watched little baby being baptized, infants helping light the Christmas candle, it occurred to me just how incongruous this passage of Matthew 24 is, and the challenge of the second coming. Now, if you had been the author of Matthew's gospel, this story that tells the life, the death, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I submit to you that you would probably want to leave these chapters out of the story. These chapters that are known as the Olivet Discourse, the last sermon Jesus gave on the Mount of Olives. Because how do you react to the news that there'll be two workers in the field, one will be left and the other taken? Two women will be grinding in the mill, one will be left and the other taken. And these pictures and images have been used, haven't they, by singers, by preachers, to plant fear in us with the lament, "I wish we'd all been ready." How do we be ready? Especially when Jesus himself establishes right at the very beginning of this passage, he says, no one is going to know the day or the hour. You're not going to know the timing. There's no roadmap for this to safely navigate you through with accurate measurements of when this will happen. And here's the more disturbing sentence. Jesus says, no one knows the day or the hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son. nor the Son. So Jesus doesn't even know when he's coming back. Jesus, our leader, Jesus, our shepherd, who's supposed to guide us through the valley of the shadow of death. What's going on here? And it's a verse that so many scholars feel quite embarrassed about. How can the Son not know what the Father knows? And so many scholars provide a range of solutions, and none of them feel quite secure. And what is interesting about this section is that the way Jesus is preparing us to live in hope is not to set us on a hill with a telescope to try and forecast the end times, but instead, he brings us right down into stories of ordinary life. He rolls out this series of stories of what it looks like to live with vigilance. And each one has a slightly different emphasis. And what seems to be holding all these stories together is that the Son himself doesn't know the day of his return. That's the underlying motivation. And to figure out what's going on here, we'll come back to this later. But let's look at these stories and what they're saying to us. First of all, there's Noah. And it's almost as if Jesus is shocking our taste buds because he describes the end times as being like the days before the flood. He says there was eating, there was drinking, there was marrying and giving in marriage. And isn't it striking what Jesus doesn't say here? Because we all know before the flood, these people were sinful, they were corrupt. But Jesus doesn't say they're very bad people. That's why they were punished. And in fact, these actions described here of eating and drinking and marrying, they're the ordinary activities, even enjoyable activities. The Greek word for eating describes people who like to experiment with recipes, with food. And the only person doing something weird was that fanatic Noah who was building the ark, this huge wooden boat with no surrounding water to set it adrift. And this is the shock. This is the surprise for us. Before the end times, life is just going on as normal. People are eating and drinking and marrying and having children, not realizing there's judgment coming until it's too late and one is taken and the other is left. I wonder if Jesus was trying to do something here and counter those experts, those religious experts who were trying to pinpoint concrete end times. And by planting this over-realized eschatology, they were also sowing fear into people. But the other extreme could also be true. Maybe the people had this under-realized eschatology that, well, there's no point in looking forward, so why bother? Let's just make do with living the way that we are. And either way, when we see these workers in the field and when we see the women grinding in the mill, it's like the parable that Jesus had said earlier of two houses that look the same. These workers look the same. The woman in the mill looked the same. Two houses worked on in exactly the same way, built the same way. But what mattered was the invisible foundations on which they were built. It was either the rock or the sand. And that's why the wise person is the one in this story who's vigilant, who's always on the lookout for Jesus coming again, a bit like a thief coming in the middle of the night. That's the second story, the thief coming in the night. Isn't it odd to think of Jesus as a thief? Just as it was odd to compare Jesus coming again to the flood, there's these incongruous metaphors that are trying to awaken vigilance in us. We've only ever experienced our house being broken into once, thankfully. It happened before the boys were born. It was the first year of our marriage. And thankfully, we were out of the house. We were playing squash. The police phoned us and said, come quickly. Your house has been burgled. And I remember on the journey back to the house, your thoughts begin to run away with you, and you begin to think about all the possessions in your house, all the things of value, what you fear might be taken. And thankfully, when we got home, there was very little damage because a neighbor across the road had seen the flashlights in the bedroom window, and she'd called the police. And so the police moved very quickly, and very little had been taken. But she was vigilant. And the moment that happened in our lives, I remember how we lived in that house very differently. We reviewed our lockup procedures, how we locked the doors. We thought about the locks we had on the doors. We looked at the windows to see how strong they were. And it changed our thinking. It changed our living. And in a way, Jesus is asking us this question. Has your life been changed by the knowledge that Jesus is coming again? Does this affect how you do your work and your living? Does it help you discern what you treasure, what you prioritize? Does it help you discern what are temptations and distractions that pull you away from your main purpose? Because all of this is what it means to be the wise man who built his house on our rock. And at our Thanksgiving service on Thursday, when we had that wonderful testimony time, I was so moved by hearing about ordinary people who are doing extraordinary things because of faith, whether it's overseas on the mission field, whether it's raising the profile of gender equality, whether it's education programs in prison, all these things, the life of transformation. This is like the second story. And then Jesus goes on to give this final example in our passage of vigilance. He says, those who are vigilant are not just like the person who's watching for the thief in the night, but they're also like the servant who's working away. Even though the master has put them in charge of the household and the master is now absent, this faithful servant is not just quietly waiting for the master to return, but he's getting on with providing food for the rest of the household. And it's in serving others. That's how this servant is preparing for Jesus coming again. In other words, Jesus is looking for people who will act in the same way, whether he's absent or present. And what Jesus is doing here is saving us from false certainties. Rather than pin our hopefulness on concrete absolutes and predictions of Jesus' return, Jesus is pointing us in a different direction, back into the ordinary, because that is where the transformed life is most evident. As you rub shoulders with your work colleagues, as you put food on the table for your hungry, angry children, your hangry children. That's where the transformed life comes to bear. And I love that little phrase at the end, the parable of the servant who's able to deliver the food at the proper time, or the food in season. Now that's a skill, knowing which food is ripe in which season. I'm still learning the Michigan seasons and what food is ready when. It's not just about having food on the table, but it's having food from the right season on the table. Bruner talks about how If you're a conservative Christian, you focus on the food aspect, having a healthy diet, having the right doctrine on the table to feed your souls. And then liberal Christians are better at reading the times, reading the seasons, finding relevant, creative, intelligent ways of engaging with culture. But the vigilant Christian is the one who's able to put the right food in the right season on the table when it's still piping hot and tempting to eat. That's our job. Nourishment for the road, not just for immediate family, but those in the workplace, those in our neighborhoods. Words spoken in the right season that are going to have an impact and an influence on our culture. Now, that's a tall order, isn't it? How do we do that? How do we get there? How do we practice this vigilance? Well, one way that Jesus is definitely not promoting is more knowledge for the sake of knowledge. It's not about gathering info or accumulating self-awareness or self-help strategies, because the common theme running through all these stories is absence and presence. What kind of thinking, what kind of attitude, what kind of work do you do when the master is absent? Because in these conditions, the temptation is not gross sin, but it's simply indifference. Do we bother to care? Do we really care? What does it matter? And that's where we go back to that opening statement, where it's important to know Jesus limited his knowledge of the second coming. Do you ever wonder about that? Why didn't Jesus just tell us when he's going to come? Why didn't he just give us the date? Our lives would be easier. This whole business of being prepared would be easier. Have you ever wondered about those moments in Scripture when Jesus didn't seem to know the future? That moment in Gethsemane when he was praying and tears were falling, where he said, "Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done." Or that moment on the cross where Jesus was dying and he said, "Father, why? Why have you abandoned me? Why?" When you ask the question, why, it's because you don't know the answer. Why, Lord? And you see, Jesus could have called down the legion of angels to save him. He was the Son of God. He could have finished it. He could have finished the suffering in an instant. He'd raised Lazarus to life. He could have saved himself by his own word, but he didn't. Instead, he faced that agony of the why and chose the limitation, the absence of full knowledge and full power. Why? Because he wanted to show how much love cost and to invite us into an authentic relationship of love where we had free choice to enter in. Many scholars have wrestled with this doctrine of kenosis. Why did Jesus empty himself? And there's many different theories on what kenosis looks like. But I like the metaphor that Steve Evans uses, that's a quote from Vanstone, to help us understand what's going on here. Listen to this. Vanstone says, "Trinitarian theology asserts that God's love for creation is not a love born of emptiness, but it's a love that overflows from fullness. Its analog is the love of a family who, united in mutual love, take an orphan into their home. They do so not out of need, but in the pure spontaneity of their own triumphant love. Nevertheless, in the weeks that follow, the family, once complete in itself, comes to need the newcomer. Without him, the circle is now incomplete. His absence causes anxiety. His waywardness brings concern. His goodness and happiness are necessary to those who have come to love him. Upon his response depends the triumph of the tragedy of the family's love. Love has surrounded its triumphant self-sufficiency and created its own need. This is the supreme illustration of love's self-giving or self-emptying, that it should surrender its fullness and create in itself the emptiness of need. Of such a nature is the kenosis of God, the self-emptying of him who's already in every way fulfilled. We as human beings, we're so limited, aren't we? We think we know what's best for ourselves, for our families, and then so easily we fall flat on our face. We're limited with our health. We get old. We get weary. When family life doesn't work out the way we want it to, we just desperately want to know, how will it all work out? How will our children grow up? How will retirement work out? Whatever our next thing is, we say to God, show us the future. And his reply to us is that he shows us the Son, who through infinite love finds a way of opening up this Trinity so that we're included in it. He creates a space for us to enter in, and we find that Jesus' love completes us. In this season, we wander at Bethlehem. In a few weeks, we'll travel to Bethlehem, that place where everyone was saying, no room, we're full up. And somehow this Christ child creeps in because he knows we need this love to save us. So what does vigilance look like? It's simply keeping our eyes on Jesus, his self-giving love, his self-sacrificing love. It looks like a man called Reverend Robert Stevie. This remarkable story we read this past week. He became a minister in London in his late 60s. Father of five, one of them died. Another, a quadriplegic from a traffic accident. His wife suffering with dementia. But even though he's living in London, he's traveling to South Wales to buy derelict churches, where faith has all but petered out. But since his ordination, he's just slowly buying church after church building, and he's now bought 12, all from his own pocket. And he says, I'm intent on attracting new fellowship and using these chapels not as museum pieces, but as centers of worship. And so father and son in a wheelchair travel from London by bus over to South Wales to help run these chapels every week. And even though a few trickle in each of these places, Stevie calmly says, I never thought I would end up here in the valleys, but the Lord has a way of moving us around. I feel completely at peace, incredibly privileged. Some people don't think you need a chapel in every town anymore, but we need to provide for the local community a place where this Bible can live and breathe. Some people say I'm eccentric, outlandish, but what I say to them is, have faith, have faith. Many hundreds of years ago, I wonder if Noah faced the same criticisms of being eccentric and outlandish. But maybe this is the picture of outrageous hope, an extravagant love. And the tragedy is, if you give up on this story, then you will go into complacency and cynicism, or else you'll try desperately to pin down concrete absolutes that will only lead you to a dead end. Jesus is the one who completes you. He is eternal love. And that's why we sing in this season, O Holy Child of Bethlehem, descend to us, we pray. Cast out our sin and enter in. Be born in us today. So may we know this love. May we be vigilant for it this Advent season, and may we make room for it in our lives today.